This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Liz Truss is the next Prime Minister of the UK after winning a ballot for the leadership of the Conservative Party. The 47-year-old replaces Boris Johnson and will be officially appointed by the Queen later tonight. Her first major challenge will be to deal with Britain's cost of living crisis. Europe correspondent Steve Kinnane reports from London.
After an eight-week campaign, the long-awaited result finally came through.
Rishi Sunak, 60,399. Liz Truss, 81,326. Therefore, I give notice that Liz Truss is elected as the leader of the Conservative and Unionist Party.
Liz Truss secured around 57% of valid votes from the party membership and told her supporters she will deliver on her promises.
I will deliver a bold plan to cut taxes and grow our economy. I will deliver on the energy crisis, dealing with people's energy bills, but also dealing with the long-term issues we have on energy supply.
And that's a challenge even an experienced Prime Minister would find hard to manage. From October, energy bills are expected to rise by 80%. And there's speculation that Liz Truss is considering bringing in a freeze on energy bills, a policy that could cost over $170 billion. That's a lot of money for a new Prime Minister who's vowed to cut taxes. Conservative commentator Tim Montgomery has told AM he doesn't think Liz Truss will go that far on energy bills.
I think it will be a more targeted measure, helping lower-income and middle-income workers as well as small businesses. But I think it will be very substantial. And despite what I've said about her being a Libertarian candidate, I think she knows that her premiership will be dead in the water almost before it's begun if she doesn't announce some huge intervention.
During her speech, Liz Truss thanked Boris Johnson to a slightly muted response from her Conservative colleagues.
Boris, you got Brexit done. You crushed Jeremy Corbyn. You rolled out the vaccine and you stood up to Vladimir Putin. You were admired from Kiev to Carlisle.
Tim Montgomery, who was once an advisor to Boris Johnson, says his old boss is likely to restart his old newspaper column and have plenty to say about the new government.
And if Liz Truss continues to give speeches as dull as she gave today in response to winning the leadership, you know, he will outflank her and Tory members will have bias remorse in some sense. But yeah, no, Boris Johnson isn't going to go away. I don't think he'll come back as Prime Minister, but he could overshadow his successor.
That's Tim Montgomery, a former special advisor to Boris Johnson, speaking there with Steve Kinnane. Canadian police have laid murder charges against two suspects in one of the country's worst mass killings, even though the men are still on the run. 10 people were stabbed to death, another 18 were injured, during multiple attacks in one of Canada's largest and remote regions. North America correspondent Jade McMillan is in the city of Regina.
Well, Sabra, police are still looking for these two men, 31-year-old Damien Sanderson and 30-year-old Miles Sanderson. They are now each facing a number of charges, including murder and attempted murder, but they haven't yet been found. They were last spotted here in Saskatchewan's capital, Regina, around midday local time yesterday. This city is several hours' drive south from where those stabbings unfolded. The attack that left 10 people dead and at least 18 others injured. And residents here are on alert. When we touched down in Regina earlier today and turned our phones back on after the flight, we were immediately sent a message warning us of what they call a dangerous person alert, basically warning the public that the whereabouts of these two men is unknown, that people should remain vigilant and cautious and not to approach them if they do come across the pair. Police here are really trying to assure the community that officers are doing everything that they can to try to find them. There are now hundreds of police officers from across the Saskatchewan province now involved in this investigation, but local police chief Evan Bray says they also need the public's help.
Any information that you or someone you know might be able to provide to us could be very meaningful in bringing about a resolution to this part of the investigation. There's a lot of grief, There's a lot of anxiety in our province and in our communities this morning and all day yesterday. And really, I think an important step for families and communities working through this will be to bring these two safely into custody.
That's Regina Police Chief Evan Bray. And Jade, what more do we know about the victims?
Well, police have said that they are likely to release more official information later today. At this point, they are only saying that, as I said, the death toll remains at 10, but the number of people injured has risen from 15 to 18. But we are starting to hear from residents in the small village of Weldon and also the Indigenous community of James Smith Cree Nation where these stabbings took place. And they have said that among the victims are a 77-year-old widower, a mother of two, a first responder, and a 14-year-old boy. The Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, says that his government is working to provide support to those communities.
Sadly, over these past years, tragedies like these have become all too commonplace. Saskatchewanians and Canadians will do what we always do in times of difficulty and anguish. We'll be there for each other. Be there for our neighbors, lean on each other, help grieve, and help heal. We will continue to do that, and all Canadians will be with you in this difficult time.
It's Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Before him, our correspondent Jade McMillan, who's in the city of Regina in Canada. Borrowers are bracing for another interest rate rise, the fifth in a row, when the Reserve Bank Board meets today. The rising cost of servicing a mortgage is also becoming a headache for state governments, with stamp duty from property sales heading south as buyers become more cautious. For more on this, I spoke earlier with our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan.
Well, good morning, Sabra. Money markets see a 90% chance of another cash rate rise from the Reserve Bank this afternoon, up another half a percentage point to 2.35%. Remember, it was only 0.1% back in May, so already borrowers have been hit with some very big rate rises and a big reality check. After today, assuming the RBA delivers, the cash rate will be at its highest point since December 2014. Now, the big question is whether the RBA board will ease off after today with gentler hikes of the traditional quarter of percentage point to wait and see. But with inflation set to hit 7.75% by the end of the year, the RBA isn't finished. So far, banks are reporting few signs of mortgage stress, but analysts think that's only a matter of time.
Much of the focus so far, Peter, has been on the pain that borrowers are experiencing, but state governments are also hurting with dwindling stamp duty revenue.
Well, that's right. The now fading real estate boom has been a financial bonanza for long-term owners who've seen values skyrocket. It's also been a windfall for state governments who are now reliant on a flow of revenue from stamp duties worth tens of billions of dollars a year. But those rivers of gold from stamp duty are starting to dry up. The Moody's credit rating agency thinks the property correction accelerated by the RBA rate rises will slice around $7 billion from stamp duty across New South Wales, Victoria and Queensland this financial year. In New South Wales, where values are taking the biggest hit, stamp duty will fall the most as borrowers think twice about buying. But already, those very high real estate values mean stamp duty does remain the biggest barrier to first home buyers.
If states then are so reliant on stamp duty revenue, can they do anything to protect that revenue source?
Well, one answer being considered in New South Wales is a land tax that could be phased in to provide assured revenue that's not reliant on any housing boom. Now, a land tax is, of course, controversial politically. Dominic Perrottet has been pushing for one back from when he was New South Wales Treasurer. And while any new tax is unpopular, it would take the pressure off those stamp duty-addicted state governments at a time when everything, including the kitchen sink, has to be thrown at paying down massive debt built up during the pandemic.
Peter Ryan there. Elective surgery for thousands of patients has been deferred or in some cases repeatedly put on hold in recent years as hospitals grapple with COVID cases and staff shortages. In Queensland, almost 58,000 people are on the waiting list for elective surgery. Doctors are worried the delays are making some patients more reliant on pain medication, while others are dipping into their savings to pay for private care. Meg Bolton reports.
Noosa resident Jane Granger spent 3 years on a public hospital waiting list for hip surgery.
Just putting my shoes and socks on, I was in absolute agony.
In that time, 3 centimetres of her bone wore away.
I was walking completely lopsided. Had the hip replacement been done when it should have been done, none of that would have occurred. I was told that the surgery had now become very complex.
Her operation was cancelled 3 times between December and April this year as Queensland hospitals grappled with rising COVID infections.
I mean, I got to a very, very low point where life was just, oh, sometimes I just thought I can't go on anymore. I just can't keep doing this, you know.
The Sunshine Coast Hospital and Health Service, which covers Noosa, has the worst elective surgery waiting times in the state. Between April and June this year, 40.1% of patients were treated after clinically recommended times, followed closely by Townsville and Central Queensland. The president of the Sunshine Coast Local Medical Association, Dr. Roger Faint, says GPs are watching their patients deteriorate as they wait.
I've got a tradie whose basically shoulder is, well, literally falling apart.
He says some patients are paying thousands of dollars to get treated in the private system.
Now, out-of-pocket costs for spinal surgery are $10,000, $15,000 minimum. So they're using their superannuation, which you can obviously access, your life savings. Who knows what they'll be doing in 5 years' time? They're probably going to be living on the pension because they've used all their money they've saved for their whole working life for their back surgery.
Others are taking more medication to manage their conditions.
So you try and help them out and say, well, let's give you a narcotic just to get you through this tough time. And then it becomes that they become addicted and they want more. And then you're stuck with somebody who doesn't understand that you can't give them more.
The president of the Queensland branch of the Australian Medical Association is Dr. Maria Bolton.
If the hospital system isn't hitting those timeframes, then there is something wrong with the system. We need all the resources we can get to ensure that we get through those wait lists, because the thing is that diseases don't wait. Patients will continue to go on those wait lists, and those wait lists are just going to get longer.
In a statement, Queensland's Health Minister Yvette Darth says there was an almost 40% increase in elective surgeries between April and June this year compared with the previous quarter. And she says to complete almost 32,500 surgeries in that time, when COVID and flu cases were also taking a toll, is an outstanding effort.
Meg Bolton reporting. Academics, think tanks and even former regulators in recent months have attacked Australia's market for carbon credits, which allows polluters to offset their emissions. And until now, the companies making fortunes from the credits have stayed silent or defended the scheme. But now, some of the biggest players in the market are speaking out. This exclusive story by National Environment reporter Michael Slezak.
So right now we're currently, there's over 1,000 cubic metres of methane.
John Falzon runs one of Australia's biggest biogas renewable energy companies.
We have, for the last 40 years, kind of collected that methane from landfills and turned it into a usable energy form. So the carbon credit comes from us removing methane from the atmosphere.
Those carbon credits are sold to big emitters in lieu of them reducing their own emissions.
We're applied a carbon credit over a certain baseline that was above business as usual.
For years, John Falzon's company, LMS Energy, has been making money out of this system, which is supposed to help make real emissions cuts happen. But he says in some cases that's not happening, and he's written to former chief scientist Professor Ian Chubb, who's reviewing the carbon credit scheme, asking for his industry to be awarded fewer carbon credits.
We would forgo some short-term revenue for the opportunity to participate in a market that is more robust and has more credibility.
For John Falzon, it's about a sustainable business model.
Because if the market doesn't have integrity, it'll crash. And so the business itself will collapse with that. So for us to have integrity is vitally important.
And he's not alone. Companies that represent about 87% of the landfill gas carbon credit market have signed letters saying the same thing.
These operators are giving up a hell of a lot of money. the government effectively was handing them a very large check for doing stuff that they would have done anyway. And it takes big people with high integrity to say, no, I'm not going to accept that. I want the method to have integrity, and that's exactly what they're doing.
Professor Andrew McIntosh from the Australian National University used to be the chair of the Clean Energy Regulator's Emissions Reduction Assurance Committee, which oversees the system.
When people are getting credits for doing stuff they would have done anyway, the net impact of that, when that credit is used by a polluter to meet their liabilities, is to actually increase emissions.
There are a lot of methods for producing carbon credits. Two more were introduced this year, including another landfill gas method.
We're at the point now where these are new methods and there is still scope to actually modify them.
Independent ACT Senator David Pocock says if needed, he'll try to block them through a disallowance motion so that new projects can't sign up for credits using them.
Once they are no longer disallowable, it's a lot harder to do that.
In a statement, the Climate Change and Energy Minister, Chris Bowen, says he won't make any changes to the scheme until he's received Professor Chubb's review. Senator Pocock says that'll be too late.
You can have projects registered that will then be generating these questionable credits for 25 years.
In a statement, the Clean Energy Regulator says the carbon credit system has integrity and Professor McIntosh's analyses didn't include enough data about costs to businesses like John Felzon's and so underestimated the incentives they require.
Michael Slezak reporting. The Prime Minister's reassuring the mining industry that Australia will remain a trusted and stable supplier of coal and gas, even as his government moves to shift to renewable power. The Senate today debates Labor's bill to lock in a 43% emissions reduction target by 2030. The Greens and crossbenchers have already pledged to support it, despite describing the bill as lacking integrity, ambition and transparency. From Canberra, here's political reporter Henry Bellow.
An election commitment is now one step closer to reality, with the government's climate change bill introduced into the upper house. But it was a different event that drew a crowd at Parliament House last night.
Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats.
As the Prime Minister addressed the Minerals Council's annual conference, telling the peak body for Australian miners that it shouldn't fear the government's climate change agenda.
For nearly a decade, the Australian political debate over renewables and resources and climate action has been hostage to a false choice between creating jobs or cutting pollution.
Anthony Albanese pledging to work with the mining sector to reduce carbon emissions in a predictable and orderly way, urging it to prioritise minerals that are essential in the production of solar panels and batteries.
Embracing renewable energy technology will attract and generate tens of billion dollars of investment. In the same way, Australia will continue to be a trusted and stable supplier of energy and resources to our key trading partners.
The government's bill to enshrine its 43% emissions reduction target into law has the numbers in the upper house, with the Greens and at least one crossbencher pledging support, despite arguing the target is too low. ACT Independent Senator David Pocock's vote will be crucial.
As a developed country, we have a responsibility to really step up and lead in this space.
Senator Pocock wants the government to publicly declare how much emissions have been cut across major industries each year, and for all major budget initiatives to be assessed for their impact on the climate.
Really common sense, ensuring that the advice given to the minister is based on the latest science.
But when it comes to negotiating, haven't you shot yourself in the foot by acknowledging that you'll support this bill even without your amendments?
This is not something I'm going to get in the way of. I've said that we need to legislate a target. As a country, we haven't played our part for a long time now, and it's time that we show some leadership. Certainly not something that I'm going to play hardball over.
Debate in the upper house was due to start last night, with Labor Senator Tim Ayres accusing the coalition of seeking to delay a vote.
This is a full-scale filibuster. We should get on with the business that this chamber needs to deal with over the course of this week.
Climate Change Minister Chris Bowen has repeatedly said the federal government is willing to consider amendments, provided they align with the government's mandate.
Henry Bellow reporting. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. According to Qantas pilots, baggage handlers and flight attendants, there's a ruthless regime of cost-cutting and outsourcing at the airline. Today, reporter Stephen Long on his Four Corners investigation into concerns it could ultimately compromise safety for passengers. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.